I'm Christopher Lydon with the free voice of independent journalism in Pakistan. Najam Sethi has had death threats from the Taliban. Three times he's been jailed by different Pakistani governments, and still he carries the banner of critical reporting and commentary in Pakistan, maybe the epicenter of extremism and real danger in the broader Middle East and South Asia. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Najam Sethi, we're getting our heads around the notion of Pakistan as the prize and the problem, maybe, in the region, much more than Afghanistan, really, maybe more than Iran. How do you score the world of Afghanistan, Pakistan these days for puzzled Americans?
You know, it wasn't always like this. There was a time when the U.S. had a strategic relationship with Pakistan during the Cold War, which lasted from the 1950s, 60s, 70s into the 80s. Mm. And when the Soviet Union broke up, that strategic relationship came to an end, and the U.S. literally walked out of Pakistan. And I think that's when anti-Americanism begins in Pakistan, and Pakistan gets into these adventures in the region, partly in Afghanistan, partly against India in Kashmir. And that led to the creation of a whole notion of political Islam as a legitimizing force for some of these adventures by the Pakistani military in the region. In the meanwhile, the United States was making Pakistan the most sanctioned country in the world for pursuing a nuclear program that the U.S. had turned a blind eye to for many years earlier when Pakistan was still a strategic ally. I must tell you that the word jihad, the way we now know it in modern parlance, I was growing up for 40 years and never heard the word in Pakistan, jihad, Islamic jihad. The first time I heard of Islamic jihad was when President Reagan talked about it and about the jihad, the Islamic jihad against the old enemy, the Soviet Union. And we suddenly woke up and said, hello, we are the ones who are supposed to know about this as jihad business. We had not heard about it. It was in our religious books, and jihad had been mentioned as a form of warfare that used to take place in the 8th century when the Prophet was and his forces were trying to conquer places.
And now you were dealing with the Hollywood version.
And now suddenly we had the Hollywood version. The Pakistan I grew up in is not the Pakistan that I'm living in today. This is a very different Pakistan. And the Pakistan with which the United States had an alliance for 30 years was a very different Pakistan from the Pakistan with which the U.S. is now seeking to forge a relationship. There is so much distrust between the two. There is so much anti-Americanism in Pakistan, there are many reasons and causes for it. But at the same time, the U.S. is stuck from having ignored Pakistan from, say, 1989 till 9/11 happened. It wasn't even on the radar screen. And we were left to fend for ourselves, having been critically dependent on U.S. aid and assistance. And then now America comes back into Pakistan with terms and conditions. We haven't looked back from that. Pakistan has undergone a radical transformation, partly because that was the U.S. demand. And in the process, Pakistan has tried to fulfill some demands that the U.S. had put forward. In the process, also, Pakistan has acquired a new range of demands for itself. Mm. And the military that had been pushed back by the arrival of democracy in the 1990s has reemerged as a powerful vehicle for change or for the status quo, depending on how you look at it, precisely because the U.S. is doing business with the military, and which has been the old story. So we are back to square one in many ways.
You, Pakistan, are now part of this strategic label AFPAC, which seems to stand for Confronting Islam, Stabilizing Iraq, maybe Finding Osama bin Laden on the Way or something. Take a quick tour of that label, AFPAC. How's it doing?
It's not doing well at all. First, Pakistan had serious objections to AFPAC. Pakistan thinks it should have been AFPAC India, because Pakistan's problems are with India, and because of Pakistan's problems in India, it has a stake in Afghanistan. That's the way Pakistan sees it. The way America sees it is, India is neither here nor there. India is Pakistan's headache. We are not into an India-Pakistan equation. For us, it's Afghanistan, and to the extent that Pakistan is a safe haven for the Taliban, it's an AFPAC problem. I think that was the error. If the US had not seen it like that, they wouldn't have done what they did. They might have taken a different strategy. When you say AFPAC, you're saying basically our problem is in Afghanistan and partly in Pakistan.
And that the problem is the Taliban somehow.
And it's only the Taliban. And the PAK part of it comes in because there are Taliban hiding in Pakistan. If they could be flushed out,
yes,
it could be, the problem would be Afghanistan. It wouldn't be AFPAC. We don't see it like that. We see some of those Taliban as potential assets, not as liabilities, because we want them to go back and run Afghanistan, however way they want to run it, as long as they're not hostile to Pakistan.
Because they're Pashtuns and they're traditionally friendly with Pakistan.
They've been traditionally part of Pakistan's social fabric, especially in the northwest frontier province, the Pashtun areas.
You can deal with their militancy. You can deal with their Sharia law.
We can't, not now. But 10 years ago, we could. Because, you know, those areas were left ungoverned spaces in Pakistan.
Hmm.
The argument was the same old argument that the British had given. These are ungovernable people. Let them be. If you don't, if you don't finger them, they won't finger you. Let them be. They're backward. They're tribal. But, you know, and they have a self-sufficient, self-sustaining economy. They don't encroach upon you. Leave them be. You stir them, it's like stirring a hornet's nest. The British suffered because these are the guardians of the Khyber Pass. These are tribes given to marauding and they live with the gun by the gun. It's the Wild West all over again. So let's not go in there. Leave them be. Which is the policy Pakistan had adopted in its, you know, since independence.
Sounds like the part of wisdom.
It was part of the old imperialist wisdom that there are areas which should be, you know, no man's land. Let's not go in there and try and do nation building there. Okay. Now, what happened is that when the Taliban were, and Afghanistan, by the way, after the civil war in the 80s, it really disintegrated. It was the nationhood was weak to begin with, but the state disintegrated, with the result that warlords crept up all over Afghanistan. And so instead of dealing with one central authority, as you did under the Russians, for example, they had a communist party and the communist party was in full control. The army was with it and so on and so forth. After that was defeated and the Russian proteges lost and were on the run, the Taliban came in. But the Taliban were riven with strife themselves because of religious differences. And then on top of that, you had the ethnic problem. The Tajiks up in the north, the Uzbeks up in the north, and the Pashtuns. So the situation became very complicated. And every ethnic community wanted to seize Kabul and establish its own government there. So in a sort of a civil war broke out, which is a legacy of kicking out of the Russians. Okay. Now, the Pakistanis got in at that time and tried to seize Kabul with the help of their Pashtun friends, with the original jihadis. They were fighting amongst themselves. And then came the Taliban, indigenous local source material, who were helped by the Pakistanis to seize Kabul. And once they seized Kabul, there was relative peace in Afghanistan. They were atrocious people. They did all sorts of terrible things, things that you and I could never live with. But as far as the Afghan people were concerned, by and large, there is no big deal for them. You know, you destroy the Buddhas, it's a huge issue for you and me. It's not an issue for most Afghans who, you know, very Islamic and very religious. And so one community, if one community suffers, which is a Buddhist community, so what? The predominant community is militant, aggressive, believes in a particular type of Islam in which you shouldn't be, you should have only one God, which is Allah, and all other statues should be forbidden and so on and so forth. That ideology came to the surface. It was always latent in Afghan society. But with the arrival of the Pashtuns and the Taliban into the central seat of power, suddenly you had a new ideology. But that was not bothering anyone. The issue, it was neither bothering the United States, nor was it creating problems for Pakistan. The issue became relevant only when Osama bin Laden decided. He left Sudan because of American pressure. He was expelled from there. And because Osama bin Laden had been part of the jihad against the Soviet Union and knew the terrain and knew the people, and he'd worked with many of these people, he decided to take refuge in our borderlands. And that's where the trouble begins. That's where the bases are established. That's where revolutionaries, Islamic revolutionaries or radicals from all over the world come to join Osama bin Laden. They set up training camps and they have one objective, the United States. Get the U.S. Because the U.S. is occupying sacred lands in the Middle East.
First get the Soviets, then the U.S.
That's right. And
people keep telling us this, I mean, Pakistanis, but I'd say this is largely unknown to the American public and very, very rarely expressed in American media.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. The American media is more interested in the here and now rather than in, you know, the whys and the whereoffs of the past, because there's a lot about every country's future, which in some way or the other, if it's linked to the United States foreign policy, in most cases, the U.S. has left a mess out there because of its short-term and long-term interests. You know, people have to then cope with the problems that are left behind. But then it's not just the U.S. that is to blame. It is the ruling elites of these countries who entered willingly and wittingly into partnerships with American defense security people and created a mess for themselves in time to come.
I want to know how American troops and force get out of that hornet's nest, but I also wonder how Pakistan imagines it can get out of this fray.
You know, if America were to decide tomorrow that, hey, enough is enough, we're pressing a button and all our troops are headed home and Afghanistan can go to hell and we don't care, because there are people in the U.S. who are now saying things like that. If Afghanistan is divided, if it becomes fragmented, if the Taliban seize power, so what? Karzai is corrupt. There's the poppies back in action, and most of the poppies smuggled to Europe or to the United States anyway. And, you know, when the Taliban were there, at least the poppy wasn't there. And if Al-Qaeda is hanging out there, well, let Pakistan deal with it, because it's now as much a threat to Pakistan as it is to anybody else. And we'll do selective covert action to continue to take people out, but we'll pull our troops out. That's a point of view that you one now hears in the U.S.
Yep. Okay,
give the CIA more power, use drones for selective bombings and the CIA for selective assassinations and so on and so forth, but pull the boys out and let the Afghans cope with this. And we will secure our homeland by other devices, by better security arrangements and homeland security and intelligence services and so on. After all, you know, we the two big oceans and we can protect ourselves. Suppose that...
Suppose it happened tomorrow.
Suppose it happened tomorrow. You know who would be the most worried country in the world?
Pakistan.
That's the fascinating part of it. So, you know, why would Pakistan be in the eye of the storm? It's not in the eye of the storm right now. Pakistan would then be in the eye of the storm.
Explain.
The Taliban would come back and they'd say, okay, Pakistan gave us some safe havens for a while. Big deal. We defeated the United States, not Pakistan. We are now flushed with victory, buoyed, strong. We have the weapons the Americans left behind. We have everything. Well, boy, we are in business. They will set up an Islamic caliphate. And then they'll say, right, now we've got Kabul. Where do we go? Where do we export our brand of heroic, victorious Islam? And say, aha, Pakistan. We've already got sympathizers and supporters in Pakistan. Let's go for Pakistan. Let's get the nukes. We now need nuclear power. Pakistan is the next target. And, you know, the thing is, Pakistan's civil society is already fractured or fracturing in many ways under the pressure of a failing economy and the alliance with the United States, which is, you know, the secularists versus the Islamists, and within the Islamists, those who hate India and those who don't, and so on and so forth. Pakistan's army would then get fully involved in a war on their borders, which it could not hope to win. If the United States can't win against these people, the Pakistan army can't win against them. Pakistan would be the next. It would be a domino. You'd forget about Saudi Arabia and Yemen. They would be trembling in their shoes. If nuclear-armed Pakistan falls to the Taliban, what happens to the region? What happens to India? What happens to the world? No, you can't afford to do that. And I think that's where the game plan is, that the exit strategy has to be one which leaves behind an Afghanistan that can be trusted, which is no longer an export breeding ground for Al-Qaeda against the United States or against anyone else, and also protects Pakistan from falling victim to the aftermath of an American withdrawal. Which is why, if this argument had been given 10 years ago and accepted 10 years ago by President Bush, we would have been in a happier situation today.
Which argument? Make it again.
The argument that we've got to leave Afghanistan in a particular way and protect Pakistan in the bargain. In other words, a very major role for Pakistan in both the building of Afghanistan and in the aftermath of American troop withdrawal. That realization is only coming home today. It's now after everything else has failed. After NATO, Europe is pulling out. And your public is now saying, hey, bring our boys back. This is not a war that we should have been there in the first place. And now the realization is dawning, hey, we need a partner in the region. And suddenly we talk of strategic interests in Pakistan. You know, we always knew the United States had a strategic interest in India because of China and because of the economy and all the rest of it. That's a long-term strategic interest. It doesn't matter who is in power and which army chief is in power or which prime minister is in power. That happened after President Clinton. 10 years ago, the U.S. entered into a strategic relationship with India after the end of the Cold War. Until then, India was in a strategic relationship with the Soviet Union and Pakistan in a strategic relationship with the U.S. But after the end of the Cold War, America suddenly says, okay, now India, we are going into India. It's like America went into China under Nixon and Kissinger. Now, under Clinton, president, under the Democrats, India is a strategic ally. And the Pakistan relationship is a tactical relationship with the U.S. My argument is this, it should be a strategic relationship because of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda factor.
But I'm wondering, the day after the United States got out of Afghanistan, what if it said, let's get out of Pakistan too? That's a dysfunctional relationship over many, many years. It has been a kind of convenient place for Henry Kissinger to enter China, for example. But the army, we pour endless money in there. They don't do our bidding. They have a split agenda themselves with the Taliban. They're unfriendly population now. Let's be done with that one too.
You know, the thing is, that's a very tempting thought. But as I explained, if Afghanistan falls, Pakistan will be a bigger victim of radical Islam than Afghanistan. If you think 9/11 was something, you know, with a population of 30 million, you know, they're hosting the Taliban and they're creating so much trouble for everyone. Population of 180 million and poverty lines increasing by the year, anti-Americanism rampant, and nuclear weapons, and a military that is unaccountable, a democracy which is failing, a population which is 60% of which is young, unemployed, imbibed with the Islam. That's a nuclear weapon that you leave behind, a bomb that is ticking away. So that's why you need a strategic relationship with Pakistan, okay, a sort of a Marshall Plan to pull Pakistan out because it matters to you. Not because of any goodwill for a country out there, but because if you don't do it, you ain't seen nothing yet.
This is helpful. All right. So on the third day, you decide, no, we won't quite get out of Afghanistan or Pakistan, but the wars we've been fighting, the military alliances that we've been dreaming about haven't worked either. Start again.
Okay. First, Petraeus is on the right lines. Petraeus has formally formulated a position which says there are good Taliban and bad Taliban. That's a good starting point. Because believe you me, in the end of the day the United States leaves Afghanistan, the position will be all Taliban and good Taliban. So it's a good starting point. I wish this had been formulated 10 years ago. Because that means you can talk and walk and fight and talk at the same time, which is good.
And you can have Taliban that's friendly to Pakistan and others that you...
And the Taliban who are anti-Al-Qaeda. That too is possible. The reason why the Taliban are clutching at Al-Qaeda is because Al-Qaeda gives them support. If tomorrow the Taliban were to be reinstalled in Kabul, there's every reason to believe that they could be persuaded to say, hey, bye-bye. Otherwise, this problem will never be solved. Get rid of Al-Qaeda. And we'll give you the money to build your nation and we'll give you the money to bring about the Islam that you want, but don't export it. I think they would be minimal to that. They too have learned their lessons in the last 10 years. If in the year 2001, they were not ready to say goodbye to Al-Qaeda, frankly, they would have if they'd been persuaded, if we'd waited. If instead of Mr. Armitage then saying to the Pakistani ISI, hey, do this, or else we'll bomb you back into the Stone Age. If he hadn't said that, if he said, hey, what do you want? Get rid of these guys. Let's do business. But of course, America was outraged. The administration had to do something powerful to show the outreach of American power. So the B-52s were sent in there. I think that was a mistake. And if they were sent in there, at that time, once the Taliban were on the run, they should have got into talk straight away with the Taliban and with the Pakistani authorities so that a vacuum was not created in Afghanistan. And I think they didn't do that. So now they're coming full circle and they're trying to do that now. So now you have Americans making contacts with Taliban, trying to draw the Karzai administration into talks, getting elections organized, reorganizing the security forces so that if and when there is a government in Afghanistan that can stand on its own feet after the Americans leave, it doesn't fall and the country doesn't slip into civil war again.
But where are we now really between a kind of military, if not defeat, a kind of endless frustration and, say, a new path? Where are we now? And I wish you'd decode those talks.
Yes, I'll decode it for you.
Karzai is having with the Taliban.
I'll decode it for you. I think the first mistake was for the home market, President Obama had to talk about a timetable for withdrawal. He should not have done that. That has only emboldened the Taliban to say, hey, just hang in there. These guys are on the way out. If they hadn't done that, if he had said, okay, we're going to go in with the troops, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, but we're also going to talk to the Taliban, that might have been a better strategy. But that's water under the bridge. I think Petraeus is saying the right things now. And
explain just what he means. Petraeus
is saying,
when he talks about an endless war.
Yeah, you know, when he talks of an endless war, that's the message for the Taliban. When President Obama talks about a troop withdrawal in stages, that's a message for the American people. I think both are not incompatible. I think Petraeus is basically sending the message to the Taliban that we are in here, we're going to fight. If necessary, we'll have boots on the ground in North Waziristan where you're based. We may end up antagonizing Pakistan, but we're not going to let you go. So don't think for a minute that you know, you're going to sit out there and then we'll go home and you'll go back to doing your bad old things. That message is getting across.
He's also telling Karzai to seek out friends in the Taliban.
He's telling Karzai to seek out friends because he realizes Karzai, without American support, would collapse in a day. Confidence in Karzai has eroded. They're also trying to build up the Afghan security forces. It's a very slow and agonizing process, and they're not terribly successful. But it is there. And I think most important of all, they're talking to Pakistan and saying, okay, you tell us what your interests are. Sorry, we didn't ask you that 10 years ago. We should have. We're now asking you, hey, how do you want to go about it? What's good for you and good for us? Let's talk about that. Not what's good for us and bad for you, which we didn't talk about, but which the Pakistan has always feared and suspected. So I think the Pakistani military and the American Pentagon are in talks, both about how to conduct the fight, who to target, how to safeguard Pakistani interests without abandoning American interests in Afghanistan. And I think that dialogue has started. The issue is, can that dialogue come to a fruitful conclusion in the next 8 or 9 months before the deadline for troop withdrawal arrives? I don't think it's going to be possible. I think you will have one deadline and then another deadline. And that's perhaps just as well. It may be that America wins in the long run while President Obama loses out. Or it may be that President Obama and America win both at the same time. I can't say that. I don't know enough about American politics. But I do know this, that the war in Afghanistan was a significant factor in the arrival of President Obama. President Bush made a mess of it, and Iraq. And President Obama brought hope back. Now he has to win this war in an honorable way. Or if at worst he can't lose it, and he has to bring the boys back.
We'll come back to that distinction. But first, Najib Sethi, what is your general scorecard on the military effort overall? I mean, this kind of starting with the B-52, the ultimate blunderbuss and sort of symbolic assault, but also the drone war. I think a lot of Americans remember somehow the Colin Powell line, you know, we do deserts, we don't do mountains. And there we are in the mountains of the mountains in the back of beyond. And we know that we miss the target many times more than we hit it. Overall, what's your scorecard on the effectiveness of the military operation?
I think the military operation is in a stalemate. The Pentagon was right to ask for more troops, but wrong not to take Pakistan into the loop earlier. I think that was that's a measure of its arrogance, that we can do it. And it's right now to try and do a holding operation while trying to launch the talks and also trying to get the Pakistanis to put their cards on the table and say, right, okay. Because the Pakistanis have been reluctant to put their cards on the table because they feared that the Americans would simply, you know, sweep the cards off the table.
What are the cards we haven't seen, other than that they want a friendly Pashtun administration in
the
Kabul?
The cards on their table are that they have certain people who they have been protecting. They want them to have a stake in the Afghanistan of the future, which is why the distinction between a good Taliban and a bad Taliban is a good starting point, because Mullah Omar was a bad Taliban. and one day he may be a good Taliban. So therefore, it's a question of swallowing some pride, number one. Number two, it's a question of pulling Mr. Karzai down a few notches and saying, hey, you got to accommodate. And thirdly, it is getting the Taliban, giving them a stake, a serious stake in power in Kabul so that they can abandon Al-Qaeda.
Sum it up. What are the chances of an American withdrawal with honor? And what are the chances of withdrawal at all?
I think there is going to be an exit from Afghanistan. It will be a slow, long, drawn-out process. It won't be an overnight thing. I think notions of winning and losing will lose meaning in the next 2 or 3 years. I don't think there will be a swift withdrawal of American forces from that region for many of the reasons that I've indicated. I think Pakistan will end up playing a bigger role, take more responsibility for what happens, and eventually success will depend on the ability of Karzai, the Americans and the Pakistanis to isolate good and bad Taliban from bad Al-Qaeda, full stop. And having done that, by accommodating the Taliban in power, then Al-Qaeda can be shooed out of Afghanistan, killed, or they can be, you know, told to flee. Shorn of the support that Al-Qaeda has from the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Al-Qaeda could not hope to survive for more than 6 months.
You're a controversial Pakistani, but I think the whole issue brings out the kind of national voice in you. You're sounding like a Pakistani patriot here.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being patriotic. My main concern is not patriotism or nationalism. My main concern is that Pakistan should not fall victim to imperialist policies by Pakistan's military or by the Pentagon in that region. I'd like to see a prosperous, safe, secure, secular Pakistan. I'd like to see the rollback of political Islam or radical political Islam. And I don't see that happening until and unless we get some of these things done. I think the Pakistani military needs a certain degree of security. And if you don't give it that certain degree of security, it is capable of adventures, as in the past, that are ruinous for Pakistan and for the region. I'd like Pakistan to build peace with India. I'd like the Americans to withdraw from Afghanistan. I don't mind if the Taliban rule Afghanistan, but I would mind very much if they began to export their ideology to Pakistan. And I would certainly like to see the Pakistani military taking its rightful place beneath the civilians, not above the civilians. And I'd like to see the civilians in Pakistan and democracy flourish and prosper. The good news here is that the civilians now, across the board, want to redress civil-military relations. They're not happy with the Pakistan Army's military adventures in India and in Afghanistan. The civilians want to build peace in the region. They want to aid and they want to trade and they want to build an enlightened country. And I want to be part of that process. And if it, you know, you may call me what you will, but back home, people don't like this sort of talk because they think patriotism demands being anti-American, being pro-Taliban and being pro-political Islam. And I'm neither of these things.
Fascinating. Will you explain to me in what we think of as loosely a dictatorship in a country run and owned in a fashion by the army, how people like you here and even at home manage to speak your minds?
That's
and you're not alone. I mean, we've talked to the novelists and other writers. How do you manage to carry the banner of a free press so casually when you know you're under terrific pressure?
Well, you know, the thing is, there was a time when the threat to the media used to come from the army and from the government. Then the situation changed and we had democracy. And under democracy, media began to flourish. Now the situation is that we have a very vibrant media. We have a very strong judiciary. For the first time in 60 years, the judiciary has staked its claim to being free of the executive. And in fact, there is a media judiciary nexus now that sustains and supports the independence and strength of the other, which is very good. This is unprecedented. There is also an underlying impulse, which is for democracy and for civilian supremacy over the military. And this is a product of Pakistan's broadly secular base, despite the rhetoric of Islam and radical Islam, or in fact, anti-India sentiment. Mm. Despite that, by and large, people still think of religion as a personal affair. And, you know, the British colonial tradition survives in many good ways, one of which is that we still cling to the notion of democracy and would like to see it work as in India. And I think that is the strong point of Pakistan. And despite the ups and downs, we've managed to retain that framework. Now, in that framework, when the military is directly in power, then we have problems. But when the military is not directly in power and the other institutions of the state are seemingly in power, the judiciary, the media, the Democrats, the parliament and so on and so forth, democracy becomes quite vibrant and quite noisy. And people like us are able to survive and say things which many people don't like. But then we don't get we are not threatened by the state. We are threatened by non-state actors like the Taliban, because who don't like what we say. So when I'm on the hit list of the Taliban, I'm not on the hit list of anybody else in Pakistan. And the government of Pakistan has provided me security, round-the-clock security, armed guards, because of this security threat. Because I was one of the few people who said that, you know, the Taliban are inimical. They're not good for us. And they're not even Islamists. And their notion of Islam is very against the whole notion of, you know, culture and peace in the subcontinent. And this is a variant of an Islam that we have never imagined. It is coming from somewhere else. And they didn't like it. So I got a lot of death threats and so on. The government and the military all have worked to ensure that this people like us are not drowned out, these voices. Because at the end of the day, these voices are good to knock some sense in the other partners. So the military is happy when I say things which are meant to knock some sense into the Americans. The Americans are happy when I say things which are said to knock some sense into the Pakistani military, and so on and so forth. So this no man's land is actually an asset in many ways. It enables you to try and build bridges with all the protagonists, all of whom distrust each other. But because you are nobody's man, in a sense, so therefore I think it's good to be Pakistan's man in that sense. Not just the Pakistani militaries, not just the Americans, not just somebody who's very pro-India or wants to have peace with India. I think the space for such people is increasing. The bigger the crisis, the space for us increases. Because people then say, hey, something's gone wrong, let's listen to what these guys are saying. Because we've been saying something else. We've been providing the alternative, the alternate narrative. And I must tell you, I'm enormously heartened. I used to edit a weekly paper, which I still do. It's called the Friday Times. It's a very outspoken paper, but a very small, limited circulation. It was aimed at the elites of Pakistan who govern, who rule, who decide. And we aimed it at them because we thought they needed to be re-educated. And I must confess that, we were only partly successful. We weren't able to effect any major paradigm change in the mindset of our ruling elites. Then I did a daily paper. I thought, weekly is not good enough. You need to have a daily go at these guys. And that paper was a success, but in a limited way. And so 30 years of my life was spent doing English medium journalism in a country where less than 2 or 3% of the people read or write English, unlike India, where the whole middle class is, you know, English-oriented and English medium. Not in Pakistan, because our education system is in an appalling state. And then last year, about 18 months ago, I decided to do a program on television in Urdu. And I must tell you, the results are hugely encouraging. The things I say, which have never been said before to the Urdu-speaking people. For example, they've been brainwashed into believing, you know, the whole thing about Pakistan was meant to be an Islamic state, the anti-Americanism that is rampant, the causes of it, how we are completely self-righteous and innocent, how India is the rogue in the region, and how America is the, you know, blah, 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 blah. This is the ideology, this is the mindset that has been created by the military in Pakistan for its own purposes. And I challenge it on a daily, on 3 times a week on television in a live program. It's the only live program, current affairs live program that goes out. And people call in and ask any question, and there's no censorship. So I have to field every conceivable question. Many are support what I say, others challenge what I say, and I keep going. And I cannot tell you that the program is now number one, number two in the country, which is to say that the ideas that I espouse and I talk about were ideas that people had never heard before. They're revolutionary ideas as far as they are concerned. And they suddenly realize that, hey, I make sense. I talk knowledge, I talk facts, I don't talk conspiracies. I try and explain things with facts and knowledge. And it seems to be working. So which is why I'm enormously heartened that this free media, has given space to someone like me, and tomorrow will give space to other people like me, people like Parvez Hoodboy and others who've also come and talked to you, who in the past hardly were ever invited to television programs because they were non gratas. The language they spoke was not patriotic or was anti-military or was whatever. We were labeled, my own past is very interesting. I was once labeled as a Russian agent in the 1960s because I was inclined to through the view that Pakistan's alliances with the United States were hurting Pakistan, not helping Pakistan. And I was seen as a Russian agent. And then after that, I became an Indian agent because I was sponsoring peace deals with India and saying we should build peace with India, not get into an arms race with India. There's no security threat from India. People said, what do you mean there's no security threat from India? And I said, there's no security threat from India. So I became an Indian agent. And then in recent times, I reverted back to being an American agent because the Taliban said this is an American agent. And now, I must tell you, with a broad smile on my face, that most people think, hey, this is a Pakistani agent.
Najam Sethi, thank you enormously. Thank you especially for your work as a Russian agent, an Indian agent, an American agent, a Pakistani agent, and for sharing a lot of it with us on Open Source.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.